And we are live from the wet and windy shores of Lake Washington. It's Jim Valley. It's Saturday Morning Wrestling, that time of the day where we get together and talk about the best of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and more. Wait a second. Kind of sounds like that radio station you listen to when you go to the dentist office. Except there are no women listening, unlike that radio station. And there's no Coldplay or Josh Groban. It's just me, Jim Valley, thinking out loud like Ed Sheeran. As we talk about the wonderful, wacky, white trash world of professional wrestling. We got a good show for you today. Coming up on the show, we've got noted author and Montreal wrestling expert, Bertrand Hébert. Or as he would be known in the United States, Bert Herbert is going to be coming up a little bit later on. We're going to talk about last night's WWE house show in Montreal with Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens. Brock Lesnar was there as well. We'll talk about that briefly because he was there. Maybe talk a tiny little bit about the roadblock tonight in Toronto, and then move on to some other things. Bert, as you know, wrote the great book, if you haven't gotten it yet, about Montreal, the secret history of Montreal, the untold history with mad dogs, midgets, and screw jobs. They also wrote, along with his partner, Pat LaPrade, wrote about LaPrade. Sorry, my French sucks this morning. Anyway, he wrote the other book that is still just in French, but it's going to get an English release, about Mad Dog Vachon. And also, he is the ghostwriter. Bert is the ghostwriter of the brand-new, soon-to-be-released autobiography from WWE about Pat Patterson. I think we're kind of limited on what we can talk about with that book, but we'll touch on it for sure and talk about that and much more as we kick off here on Saturday Morning Wrestling. Here on PWTorchLivecast.com. So be sure to tell your friends about it. The show's been growing. I think it's been good. But it would always help if you want to spread the word if you enjoy the show as you're out. And I think it's a good time for Saturday Morning Wrestling, reliving the era where you'd get up and watch WWE Mania or Superstars or Memphis or Florida or 605, whatever you watched as a kid growing up. This is what we try to relive. You know, after the week's done, how many people need to analyze Raw or the push of Roman Reigns or Shane McMahon? I mean, it's all been said. It's all been done. So when you're out with your kids or in your mom's basement or plotting your manifesto to take over the world, whatever you do on Saturday mornings, just a good time to have fun and reminisce about the good old days. If you want to get something in that's not about Montreal, you can do that right now at 646-721-9828, 646-721-9828. We can chat a bit. Or if you want to talk to Bert, we can do that too, coming up in just a little bit here on Saturday Morning Wrestling. And that's one of the things I did want to touch on before we get into the meat of the show, is that I think I do my show a little bit differently than Pat and Bruce and Wade, of course, and Jason Powell and Caldwell and everybody here at the ever-loving Torch, is that, you know, I try to set the table for you. It's more like a radio show, more like a live show. I mean, certainly a lot of people time shift now and download later and listen to it later and maybe don't have time necessarily on Saturday mornings to listen live. But if you do, you know, I try to do things and make it more organic, you know, kind of set the table and maybe you can respond and we'll do it in a live sort of dialogue-ish way. But that's what we try to do here on the Saturday Morning Show, as opposed to you just calling up with random questions. And don't get me wrong, some of the random questions are good. We're working on some guests here, as a matter of fact. I reached out to the younger brother of Jay Youngblood, Chris Youngblood, Chris Romero, and we're going to have him on the show in the near future and talk about the road to Greensboro. So I'd like to do things sort of organically and work with you and sort of have a give and take. It's kind of the way I do things here on the Little White Trash Saturday Morning Wrestling Show. A couple of things I do want to get into before we go to Bert and your phone calls. I do want to talk about the WWE Hall of Fame. Got three big announcements this week, including Ray Traylor, the Big Boss Man, which he's a perfect guy, in my opinion, for the WWE Hall of Fame. Well, aside from the fact that he's not breathing, but other than that, he's about perfect a wrestler. You know, a lot of people are very critical of the WWE Hall of Fame, and I think it's unfair. You know, I mean, it's not a real Hall of Fame in the sense, you know, you've got to have statistics or you've got to be a draw. You know, you've got to sold, you know, X many tickets or merchandise or pay-per-view. And I know, like, for example, you know, the Wrestling Observer, you know, which has its own Hall of Fame. And that's good. I mean, you know, Dave Meltzer does his Hall of Fame and it's based on statistics and actual goals and things like that. You know, actual, you know, metrics for his Hall of Fame. But, you know, the WWE, and he criticizes the Hall of Fame for WWE. Oh, basically anybody can go in. And Dave is really a pretty fair guy, I think, and a tremendous journalist and a great credit to the wrestling industry. But I think he's a little hard on the WWE Hall of Fame. I mean, they, people say, oh, it's a marketing tool and it's to sell tickets for WrestleMania weekend and things like that. And that's true. But I always look at it as a Hall of Memories more than a Hall of Fame. It's a Hall of Good Memories. And I think, you know, with the exception of the limo driver that's in, it's like everybody that's in there has given people good memories over the years. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you look at it that way, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, so you have people in there like the Big Boss Man who did create a lot of great memories for the WWE and of your childhood or what have you. And, you know, Ray Traylor was very much a guy who was a survivor. And I need to look it up because I don't think I knew this until a couple of years ago when they had WWE Classics on Demand and they uploaded one of the Saturday shows, one of the NWA World Championship Wrestling shows, where Ray Traylor was on there as just a job guy, a big fat job guy with Tully Blanchard. And he went up for the slingshot suplex and he had a great attitude. And Dusty Rhodes, because, you know, it was the 80s and Ray Traylor was a big guy and willing to work and do what was asked, and those kind of things were important back then, you know, decided to create the Big Bubba Rogers character. And that's the way a lot of people started, a lot of big guys. Kevin Nash started that way. Ric Flair has talked about his podcast that he would have liked to have seen Braun Strowman start as a manager, as a bodyguard type of character, so he could sit by the ringside and learn. And that's what Ray Traylor did. I mean, and what better way to be? What better tree of knowledge to be under than the Midnight Express and Jim Cornette? I mean, criminy. That's a Harvard education. And, of course, you know, is what happened with a lot of people. You know, he did well in the NWA and the UWF and things like that, but it really took off for him in the WWF as the Big Boss Man. Once again, I mean, you can say what you want about the WWF, and Vince killed wrestling, and Vince killed the territories. Vince did this, and Vince did that. But when you really look at things, by and large, there are more guys who did better in the WWF than they ever did in the NWA or WCW or what have you. I mean, certainly there are your failures, your Mark Maros, your Lex Lugers, things like that who did better in the WCW, the Turner organization, or the Crockett organization. But by and large, more people did better when they went to the WWF, and Ray Traylor is a perfect example. I know that when I went, or when I saw him there, I was like, oh boy, you know, he wasn't that successful in the NWA. How successful is he going to be in the WWF? And he turned out to be one of the best drawing opponents of Hulk Hogan's career. And that's saying something. In the fact that at the time that he was wrestling Hulk Hogan, it was just a grudge match. It wasn't for the WWE title, because Randy Savage was the champion. And I also remember when Big Boss Man first came to the WWF, you know, he came in as his prison guard, and I thought, oh my gosh, how ridiculous. What a cartoon character that is. And of course, Vince McMahon talked about how he was a prison guard, and I was like, yeah, sure he was. I mean, how old is the guy? How would he have time to be a prison guard in his life? And really, come on, don't be ridiculous. And guess what? He was a prison guard. In real life. I don't know. There's so many lies in wrestling. Who knew? Anyway. It's just one of those things. But, I mean, he went on to have a great career as far as, you know, being a babyface who was a very over babyface. And he was a great heel with Hulk Hogan. And, you know, he had a great run there from like 88 to 93-ish. And then, you know, like everything that goes up must come down in the WWF. And he went back to WCW is the Boss, and that was ridiculous. I mean, you know, I mean, I can't believe that those idiots in WCW didn't realize that that was a copyright infringement, but I mean, come on. How could you not know that? And then became the guardian angel in Big Bubba Rogers. And I got to be honest, I was kind of like, this guy is burned out. He's crispy. He, you know, but then he went back to the WWF and, you know, had a nice run again, even doing ridiculous things like with Al Snow and the pepper steaks and the big bar, the Big Show's dad and goofy things like that. But that guy was always on. You know, sure, he had some stinkers, the kennel match and stuff like that. But, I mean, everybody's career has some goofy, regrettable things, no matter what you do, even if you're in wrestling or not. I mean, geez, this is goofy and regrettable, and I'm doing this show. So why not? But Big Boss Man, I think he belongs in the WWE Hall of Fame. I mean, he's great. It is a hall of memories, and he did a lot of memorable things. He's a very memorable character, and he belongs, I think, in the Hall of Fame. He's also one of my favorite characters in the WWF WrestleFest arcade game, which I have downstairs in my game room. I have a real WrestleFest, so that's some points right there. Anyway. Also, the Hall of Fame, Stan Hansen. I mean, goes without saying, probably the biggest American star ever in Japan, one of the highest paid wrestlers, and just a general badass kind of guy. He definitely deserves to be in any Hall of Fame by any standard. You know, not only is he memorable, but he drew. I mean, big time drew. Big, big, big draw. And Jackie Moore, Miss Jacqueline, Miss Texas. You know, why not? You know, she earned it in the sense that, you know, she ran the roads, you know, worked for nothing in Memphis and, you know, did really well. And there's nothing wrong with, it's like a gold watch. And she definitely deserves a gold watch. There's nothing wrong with that. So those are my thoughts on that. I also want to talk briefly. We'll talk a little bit later. I may talk about it with Bert. Let's get to some calls because we're lighting up the phones. Thank you for calling in. The calls have been a little down lately. And I was like, where the hell did everybody go? Did I offend everyone? Did I make you mad? Good, we got calls back today. And that's what I like. I like the interaction because I'm a radio guy. I don't know if you remember radio. But people would call in and you'd interact and it would be live. And I prefer the live aspect as opposed to just you passively downloading it and everything. So that's good. Let's take some calls. Let's go to computer. 607, you're on the live cast. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hello, my name is Sridhar from San Jose, California. May I just ask, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. I didn't catch your name again. What was it again?
It's Sridhar. It's an Indian name, so I didn't expect you to be able to pronounce it back to me.
I apologize. Yeah. I've been in radio so long, and you wear headphones that you do go. Yeah. I'm probably a little deaf, so I apologize. Go ahead.
No problem. Well, actually, on that note, actually, I heard your show. I think it was either the first or second show where you talked about your coma, and that was a very touching story. And I just want to say I'm grateful that you survived that very near tragedy and are still with us today, because I love your shows on PW Torch, and I would listen to the live cast on Saturday morning more often. It's convenient being on the West Coast because the weekday live casts are during my work hours, but I tend to be able to sleep until late, so I don't usually get the call in live, but I am today. I wanted to ask about, I know you are familiar with the Portland, old Portland territory, and I don't know anything about Playboy Buddy Rose. I've only really been educated about wrestling through the WWF since the early 90s. When I saw, I think there was just one Madison Square Garden house show where they showed Playboy Buddy Rose, who was a jobber to the British Bulldog. I think it was 1991. He was incredibly overweight. When I went back and read about him on Wikipedia and then maybe just looked up one or two videos, and then when Roddy Piper passed away, then we talked about how much of a legend Playboy Buddy Rose was. I just wonder, my question is, how did he go from being a big star in Portland to this out-of-shape guy who was not given a push and had no... I don't know, no future in the wrestling business, and of course, and I know he was diabetic and sadly he passed away, and I think it was 2010. But if you could maybe educate me a bit more on the rise and fall of Playboy Buddy Rose, I'd find that very interesting. So I'll hang up and listen if you don't have any follow-up questions for me. And thanks very much. Great show.
Thanks so much for the call. I really appreciate it, man. That's awesome. Great call today. God, we just kicked off. Awesome. First time caller that I've had, and that's amazing. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Playboy Buddy Rose is a very complicated guy. Sort of like, I guess the place to start with Buddy Rose is not the beginning of his career just yet, but is when wrestling in the 80s went from territory where you didn't necessarily have to have the best body and everything, and then it went to the body image era where you had to be jacked and you had to be over 6 foot and everything. You know, a lot of guys like Tommy Rich, who didn't have the best body. He was a big star, and then suddenly, boom, you had to have a body, and he kind of went by the wayside in the early 80s. A guy like, say, Dutch Mantel or a Bobby Jaggers or what have you, you know, guys like that who did well in the terror. Mike Graham would be another one who were very popular in the territory days and did fine in the territory days, but suddenly wrestling became a much more cosmetic business. And a lot of guys were left behind. A lot of quality guys were sort of left behind in that era because it went to a more cosmetic industry. And Buddy was brilliant. And he and I have some history that I don't want to get into because Buddy is dead, and I just want to talk about the positive things. But I know there are people listening who know that Buddy and I have history, so I want to acknowledge it. And honestly, I regret it, even though I'll be honest, I wasn't wrong. But I do regret it, and I do wish it wouldn't have happened. And that's all I want to say about it because I don't like to speak ill of the dead. I just want to talk about the positive things. We'll have to talk about a few things. I mean, he was kind of a drug guy and a party guy, and you have to include that if you want to tell an accurate picture of Playboy Buddy Rose. But he was a Minnesota guy who grew up watching Vern and the AWA and things. And, you know, he started out setting up the rings and working the ring truck and a big wrestling fan. And he was part of the early Vern Gagne camps of the 70s with Ken Patera and Sergeant Slaughter and Flair. I think he went to the camp after Flair. He wasn't in Flair's camp. But, you know, you see some of a little bit of the same footage on the WWE Network of that barn with Vern. I mean, can you imagine, you know, working in that barn with Vern Gagne, and it's like it's already freezing outside in the Minnesota winters, and Vern is just an animal for training because Vern was a legitimate Olympic wrestler, and you know, you're running, and even, you know, Ken Patera has talked about it, Flair's talked about it, you know, he quit several times and everything like that. And Buddy, God bless him, was you look at the body, and he was never in great shape. But, you know, he was athletic, and he made it through that camp, and he made it through being, you know, they picked on him a lot. Because, you know, he didn't look like an athlete, he just looked like a geeky, nerdy wrestling fan, and he put up with a lot of crap to make it through. And he was a job guy in the beginning, wrestled under his real name, Paul Pershman. Went to Texas after Minnesota and kind of told him around the Midwest for a bit. And that's where things kind of started for him in the sense that, he had the first match with Kevin Von Erich. Kevin Von Erich's first match was with Paul Pershman, Buddy Rose at the time. And, Terry Funk gave him the name Playboy Buddy Rose, which, when you think about it, sounds also a lot like another name that Terry Funk gave to another guy, Playboy Gary Hart. Think about that for a second. So Buddy came up here to Portland, and, you know, this was his biggest and, you know, famous territory. He did really, really well up here in the sense that he had a really good mind for angles and things. And the Portland territory was different in the sense that, you know, people always talk about bookers and what have you, and Buddy was sort of the de facto booker, but it was a much more casual situation up here, in the sense that people sort of offered ideas and things. There wasn't one head guy, and Buddy became kind of the de facto unofficial booker because he had a lot of ideas that worked and got over and things, but it was never like an official thing, like Dusty, say, or whomever, Eddie Graham or whatever. There wasn't really a top guy. And Don Owen, the promoter up here, you know, he had a cattle ranch, and that's where he made a lot of his money. And so, you know, wrestling to him was, you know, he made money. Don't get me wrong. Don Owen made a lot of money in wrestling. But it was like his 1B business as opposed to his main source of income. Because Don, I think his son still owns the cattle ranch, and they do really well. I mean, the guy was already pretty much a millionaire. And so, you know, he had a certain attitude. And I think that's also because he had another business, another reason why Don Owen was known as a good payoff guy. So Buddy came here in the mid-70s, and he feuded with Dutch Savage and Jimmy Snuka and all those guys. And, you know, and he was the main bad guy. And, you know, the fans would look at him and see that, you know, he wasn't much to look at, really, but for some reason he always won, and that just infuriated people. Made everybody so mad. And, you know, Buddy, you know, as time went on, you know, the legend of Buddy Rose grew, and it really took off. I mean, Jimmy Snuka was a big deal when he feuded with Buddy Rose, and Dutch Savage was a big deal, and Ed Wiskowski, Colonel DeBeers, was, you know, his main tag team partner. And the other thing that Buddy did was he had Buddy Rose's army, where he'd, you know, it would sort of like Buddy was the general of the army, and Ed Wiskowski was like the first lieutenant of the army, and then usually they'd have two underneath guys. One guy that I want to get on the show who was part of the army for a while was Rip Rogers. And I should get Rip Rogers on and have him talk about everything. But you know, and that was interesting. And sorry, I'm just getting some stuff ready here. But probably the most famous thing was it really just exploded when Roddy Piper came in. And he was amazing as far as, you know, the interviews and stuff. And, you know, he was the perfect foil for Buddy Rose. And Buddy brought in the sheep herders. And it was just an amazing, I can't express how hot the time was. I mean, Piper was just really at his peak as far as promos and that just I don't give a crap attitude and just so clever and just amazing. It was a great time to be a kid and watch all that stuff. And, you know, they worked up to a hair match and a loser leave town match where they were some of the biggest matches of Don Owen's career promoting and things, you know, not since the days in the 60s of Lonnie Mane and Portland Wrestling been on fire that much. And so much of it had to do with the logical step booking of Buddy Rose. And it all made sense, and it was creative, but not overly cute, if you know what I'm saying. And, you know, it was all very logical, and you could follow, and it was brilliant. And Buddy went to the WWF with the run with, you know, Bob Backlund, and, you know, he did really well, a lot better than people expected, because, yeah, again, you know, the body era was started, and WWF was kind of the land of the monsters and the punchers and kickers. And even in his book, Backlund puts over Rose as a guy who drew surprisingly well and also was willing to do anything, even if it was quote-unquote embarrassing for him, just for the sake of the show. And, you know, Buddy said, you know, even in his book, Backlund said, and I didn't know this at the time, but Buddy had the run with Backlund right before Superstar Graham came back. And Backlund claimed that, I think it was Providence. I think it might have been Providence. But in Providence, the promoter there wasn't impressed with the reaction that Superstar Graham got. So he gave Buddy a few more shots on top because he didn't think Graham was really drawing when he came back with the karate gimmick against Backlund. So, you know, Buddy did well, but then, you know, the business kind of shifted. Again, it was bodies, it was cable television, and Buddy didn't look impressive to the casual fan. Now, here's a story that Roddy Piper told me, and this is honest-to-goodness truth. I heard this from the man, because we were talking about Buddy's career one time, and, you know, I asked him the question, you know, why didn't Buddy do better? And a friend of mine, who's not in the wrestling business but knows a lot about it and is very close, described it as too lazy to work, too nervous to steal. You know, Buddy wasn't the most ambitious guy in the world. didn't, you know, he liked to watch TV, he liked his soap operas, he liked his modern conveniences, he liked technology. You know, he was the guy that bought a VCR before they were really popular, and almost all of the footage that you see on YouTube of Portland Wrestling came from Buddy Rose's collection of taping, and that's why he's in so much of it, because he just wanted to watch himself. But, you know, when Roddy Piper went to Mid-Atlantic, the World Tag Team Champions were Gene and Ole Anderson. And Gene had his heart attack, and they brought in Ray Stevens to fill in to take over for Gene, because Gene couldn't wrestle anymore. Well, Roddy Piper called Buddy and offered him that spot before they offered it to Ray Stevens. And Buddy didn't take it. And according to Piper, Piper said that he didn't take it because he didn't have enough confidence. But they would have brought him in as a World Tag Team Champion. And, you know, who knows where things could have gone. Maybe he could have been sort of, I don't know, would have had a better career. But Buddy sort of made the move national, you know, in 85 with WrestleMania, because he was the executioner in the first ever match against Tito Santana at the first WrestleMania. And that was because Booker George Scott apparently wanted to do something with him. And if you recall that Bobby Heenan was his manager and stuff, but he didn't really do anything. And I, even as a kid, I kind of wondered back then, it's like, I don't know that Buddy's really going to get, you know, the opportunity to shine, because he's not a big body. And it's just, he just had a different sort of style. And Buddy apparently was found passed out in a lobby somewhere or in a locker room somewhere during that era. And they let him go. And he went down to Florida with the Dying Days of Florida and kind of had a brief feud with Kendall Windham that didn't go anywhere. And then he kind of, you know, just went to the AWA. And, you know, he's kind of, in a sense, he's historically lucky, because, you know, that he worked with Shawn Michaels, who went on to become a future legend. You know, I mean, think about it. If they would have just wrestled, say, like the Top Guns or something like that, some guys who didn't go anywhere, you know, Buddy's legacy wouldn't be what it is in wrestling, and people wouldn't remember. And then, of course, after that, Buddy got really fat, and he did the blowaway diet. And people always, when they talk about Buddy, they always talk about the blowaway diet, because that was, you know, seen on the Saturday night's main events and things like that, and, you know, the last major run or popular run of his career. But he was kind of just done by that point, you know. It was kind of, the wrestling business had passed him by, and it was just a completely different animal, and Buddy was just, it was just, you know, kind of done by that time. And it makes me sad, because his legacy was so much more as far as his creativity and his work in the ring being much more athletic for his body type and things like that. I mean, he really is a local legend that people still talk about to this day in Portland, where, you know, he threw the Pacific Northwest title off a bridge in Portland, and that was a big deal. And he did so many other things here in Portland. And, you know, whenever people talk about, oh yeah, he's 217 pounds in the blowaway diet, it's almost like with the Iron Sheik, where people always only talk about the Sheiky baby and make him humble and stuff. You know, it's sad that he's known more for being a big fat guy than kind of the brilliant stuff that he did. And I'll tell you what, we'll work on doing a Pacific Northwest show here and talk more about Buddy Rose and, you know, about some of the stuff that he could have done. But it's really a tale of the wrestling business changed, and Buddy, for whatever reason, didn't want to change with it. So that's kind of a synopsis of Playboy Buddy Rose and everything that he's done with wrestling. But we should get into that again, and I should see if Rip Rogers wants to come on and talk about being in Buddy Rose's army and all the stuff that he learned from Buddy Rose. We'll definitely do that one time here in the future. And I appreciate the call from San Jose. That's awesome. Well, let's go to our guest. He is a well-known author. He wrote one of the best books, I think, that has been written in wrestling about the history of Montreal. He's also written, co-authored another book with his partner, Patrick LaPrade, talking about Mad Dog Vachon, but currently it's still in French. We'll find out when that's coming out in English. And he's the ghostwriter of a book that's going to be coming out here shortly from WWE about Pat Patterson. Joining us now on the show is Bert Ronnie-Bert from Montreal. Bert, what's going on, man?
Nothing special this morning, but, you know, I'm very happy to be on the show.
We love it. I have met Bert a couple of years ago, along with Pat, at the get-together, the Greg Price get-together in Charlotte, where they were selling their books. And I just happened to be standing there at the the table when someone was deciding to buy a book, and I told the guy what it meant to me, and he ended up buying the book, and I'm still waiting for my royalties. Where are my royalties on that book? Jeez, Pat.
Yeah, but I mean, Pat, you got the ball rolling for us that weekend. After that, we kept selling them books, so that was cool.
That's right. Yeah, you owe me. You won't. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. That's why I'm on the show.
That's right. It's a great book, and it sells itself. Well, we'll talk about the book in a second, but let's talk about let's do some modern wrestling a little bit. You were at the house show last night in Montreal. Tell us about the show last night.
It was a good show. You know, I've seen worse and I've seen better as far as house show goes, but it was pretty well balanced, and you know, had great crowd reaction. And you know, I've seen the last three house show in Montreal, and you know, they're finally evolving slowly. Too slowly to my taste, but you know, the house show presentation is evolving from time to time, and they're adding more stuff and they're using better the new set that is a miniature Raw set that they have for the entrance, and they're using also the social media to have a camera at ringside that takes images, and they use that on the screen. And so I think, you know, the house show should evolve to where you're basically seeing a fake Raw or fake SmackDown as a house show, because this is what people see on television. And this is why TV taping usually draw better than house shows, is people want to see what they see on television. So they should try, especially with how easy it is to have video up and pre-tape stuff, they should like really build their house show. And they're getting there slowly. They're moving stuff around. They had the guy from NXT, I think it's Rich, that was kind of a host. They used to do that in the 90s with Ray Rougeau in French in Montreal, where he was going into the crowd and he was doing contests and, you know, making the different things happen and talk about different things. And he was really good in that role for the house show, making it special. He brought one fan from the bleachers. They brought them to ringside as a special, and they gave a prize to another one at ringside. And so they did a lot of good stuff as far as interaction with the crowd, which I think with our show is what they can't do on television, is the more interaction they can get with the crowd, the better, because this really made the experience special. Because let's face it, with the house show, there's always that drawback that, you know, it really doesn't count as far as making history or anything like that. So it's always good to make it a very personal experience. It was a strong show. I mean, historically, you know, for us, me and Pat, it was like really special because, you know, when we had Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjob came out, you know, El Generico and Kevin Steen were good indie guys, you know, at the top of our indie class here in Quebec, but, you know, they were not yet in WWE, and, you know, who knows, you know, where the future would go. And they did, in fact, yesterday main evented the Bell Center with Dean Ambrose in a triple threat match for the Intercontinental Championship. So I think we were on the right path by including those two as the new breed of Quebec wrestler in the line of the Mad Dog Vachon and the Rick Martel and the Dino Bravo and the Rougeau family. So it was pretty cool. You know, the last time two Quebecers were in the main event position on a WWE show in Montreal was when Jacques Rougeau had the retirement match with Carl Ouellette in 93. So, you know, frankly, that's something I wasn't sure I was going to see again, two Quebecers in the main event at the Bell Center. So, you know, that was a really fun night. I had the kid with me and my friend and my niece, and, you know, so we had a great time, and it was a good show.
I assume you know both Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens. How long have you watched their careers and known them?
I mean, what is kind of strange is they started to came up at a time where I was not completely out of the local scene, but I wasn't in the mix of it as much. And so I work with Kevin a few times, you know, on TOW show, and when I work for Paul LeDuc's promotion in Montreal, I had him on my shows and stuff like that. I actually never worked with Zayn, which is kind of weird, because I've pretty much worked with everyone that has ever laced a pair of boots in the last 20 years in Quebec, but him. You know, it's so much fun to see those guys, you know, work hard, and you can see the difference at some point you know, when they come up by the dedication they put into their career. And for me, I mean, the worst thing as far as indie guys go usually is that when they start believing their own hype, you know. Because, you know, if you were that good, you wouldn't still be here type thing. So you have to keep on getting better. You have to keep learning. You have to keep listening to everything you can get. Advance, change, make switch, tweak your whatever, and take any advice you can get. And usually what people do, you know, as soon as they start getting a little buzz or they start getting a little bit more bookings, they start getting the big head, and they start thinking that they're going to be the next thing, and they're going to be drawing 1,000 people every time they're on it, which usually doesn't happen. But what was cool about those two is that they were never in a position where, you know, people were saying, you know, who the hell do they think they are? They kept being humble, even though they were getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they just kept on learning. And even in WWE, you know, they still had stuff to learn before, you know. For Kevin, it took very short time in NXT to be ready, but for Zayn, when, you know, bearing the injuries, it took a little bit longer. But, you know, they even there, they still had stuff to learn, and that's a really good attitude for indie guys, is to always think that there's something more to be learned. You know, I've been following the wrestling business since 1981. I've been reading, checking, working, writing, and whatever you can think of, even, you know, kind of appearing in a wrestling match myself at some point. But, and I think I'm still learning something every day. I still have to evolve with the business and see where the business is going and how things are and what people want, you know. It's hard because there's a lot of the whole old school psychology that is hard to keep on, because guys today, you know, the pace is so fast. There's so much flashy move, and there is a crowd that like that spectacle of acrobacy, or, you know, and you know, so it is hard for the guys to learn the right way and find the difference, because there is a difference between drawing 2,000 people or 1,000 people and being in front of 8, 10, 15, 20, 25 and 80,000 at WrestleMania. It doesn't draw exactly the same crowd, and you need to be able to touch everybody.
Yeah, you got to talk them into the building.
Yeah,
and I wish we had more opportunity for more promos, even just a minute or two. You know, if Kevin Owens, you know, he's not going to be the main event guy that's going to get, you know, a 20-minute promo to open up Raw right now. But I mean, even if you just give him the mic as he comes into the ring and just to say a couple of things to get over, I think that'd make a big difference.
Yeah, because Kevin has that thing where, you know, whatever he's saying, he's kind of scoring a point every time, even though it's short. He'll score something. I think he was on commentary on SmackDown a few weeks ago. I don't know. I think it was a 6-man, which wasn't that great of a match, if I remember correctly. But, you know, the match was cool to watch, because whatever Kevin was saying during the match, he was very entertaining, and, you know, he was making a lot of points that made sense as far as storyline and getting everything moving. So I think that's a gift, you know, to be naturally able to mark points as far as getting whatever you're talking about over and advancing the storyline.
Yeah. Well, let's run down the show real quick. Just run down the matches real quick and give us a little thumbnail of how the night went.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, they opened the show with Enzo and Cass against Dash and Wilder in a non-title match with the NXT, you know, Tag Team Champions. And Enzo and Cass won that match. Very entertaining, really good opener. They did, actually, Enzo and Cass did a little bit more than they usually do on television on NXT, which I think was really cool. They had a few good flashy spots that the crowd loved. And I would, you know, estimate that maybe 1/3 of the crowd really knew who they were, you know, which gives us a rough idea how the network is doing. You know, me and La Prade, we came up with a number around 7,000 to maybe 8,000 yesterday for the house show, which was pretty good compared to the one in September. And, you know, so it's about 1/3, I would say, really new and try to get into the chant. But, you know, it was kind of off a little bit because of the fact that not everybody knew the chant, but, you know, people got into them pretty quickly, you know. They, I think they have a great hack, and it all depends on how it's played on the main roster, but obviously, you know, there's something there. They had Jack Swagger over Stardust, which was okay. not much going on there as far as storyline. Then they had Goldust over Victor of the Ascension, and they did the thing which I read they did a few places where, you know, after the match, Ascension took on Goldust, then R-Truth made the save, then, you know, R-Truth and Goldust kind of played the little thing they play on TV right now of I like you, I don't like you type thing, which I'm not really into, but, you know, crowd seemed to like it, so that was nice. More than I was expecting it, you know, I we could see that people knew what the storyline was, which was, meant that they've been watching Raw and SmackDown. So, again, you know, it's not just like the Harlem Globetrotter or Wrestling is in Town, let's go. It, you know, people there's actually people watching the show and keeping up with the storyline, depending on the reaction we got last night. Then we had the match was scheduled to be Brock Lesnar against Bray Wyatt. Wyatt cut a promo saying that he had made a deal with the devil, Vince McMahon, and that, you know, instead of being him against Brock, it's going to be Harper and him against Brock in an handicap match. Well, that turned out not so good for Bray, as he basically didn't enter the match and never tagged in, and, you know, basically let Harper took the brunt of everything, and it was basically a showcase of, you know, suplexes. I would have loved a little bit better match, you know, but it's kind of hard, you know, to give Harper so much on Brock that it was going to be better. But, you know, I would have loved to have seen the gator spot on Brock, with maybe Brock turning around the gator spot on Harper or something. I think that would have been nice. But, you know, people loved it. You know, it's Brock Lesnar is an attraction. You know, Paul Heyman was there, so they got into him, you know, saying my name is Paul Heyman and all of that. So it was fun. Then we had intermission. You know, what would be a wrestling show without intermission? After that, Charlotte got over Natalya when Natalya tried to get it to Flair, who was also there. So people got into the Who a lot, and that was a lot of fun. But, you know, she tried to get to Flair, and Charlotte used that to get to her and put her feet on the rope, and she won, you know, Flair style. Then we had the New Day taking on the League of Nations, Barrett and Sheamus. So they had the New Day cut a promo, you know, making sure that everybody would root for them as babyface, saying how they didn't like the League of Booties, as they say. So that was a good match. I'm not too sold on the League of Nations. I think, you know, they suffer from a credibility issue. They've been used as cannon fodder for Roman Reigns for so long that, you know, it's kind of hard to take them seriously. Hopefully, you know, this will turn into something good, and it'll make New Day the biggest baby face ever, because, you know, they're selling those unicorn thing, $20 a pop, you know. People
were they
wearing
popular? They are, huh?
Well, I don't know. My kids had fun counting how many they, and, you know, they sold for a few $1,000s worth of a unicorn.
Wow.
So
that's amazing.
You know, I'm not sure people realize what am I going to do with that once the show is over. But, you know, during the show, people have a lot of fun with it. So if they turn babyface, they're not going to be able to produce those things fast enough. You know,
that's
and
so
this
funny.
Is, the
is
and
it any more
the
ridiculous
event
than the Cobra Sox? It's no more ridiculous than the Cobra Sox, is it?
No, I don't think so, yeah. It's no more. And, you know, if they do, I've heard rumors of that big unicorn-type entrance that they have in mind for WrestleMania for the New Day. If they do something like that with, like, horses with unicorn on them and stuff, you know, who knows? You know, that thing will take off. You know, my almost 16 years old bought himself a New Day T-shirt. And, you know, with the unicorn and the three guys riding it, and he wants to wear it at school. So, obviously, that's working, you know, as far as, you know, making sense with a younger crowd and, you know, making it cool. And, you know, if he wants to wear that at school, you know, that's a pretty good sign that that thing is working. So, and that's one thing as far as I go, you know. I'm at a point where I don't judge everything on what I like or what I think or, you know, or what I would buy myself. You know, I try to watch how my kids react, you know. I know people my age, you know, I'm going on 45, think, you know, and people older than me, you know, I've been told, I've told me that, you know, AJ Styles' haircut doesn't make any sense, blah, 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 and you can't see his eye, and blah, blah, blah. But my 11 years old, you know, has the same haircut now because he wants to look like AJ, you know. So, obviously, you know, this is working to a certain audience, and, you know, I think in wrestling it's really important to have character and to have storylines that will get younger fans into it, because, you know, this is where you're going to get the new fan and the future, and you need those people to be fans. So that just makes sense, you know, to go with whatever is working. And you don't have to like it yourself or think that it's something you should buy, but, you know, if it's working with a crowd, a part of the crowd, you know, I think it's something we should go behind, at least.
Hey, Bert, real quick, I agree with you in the sense that every generation, their rite of passage is to have terrible hair, terrible fashion, and like terrible music. That's what you're supposed to do at that age. You're supposed to look back and go, what the heck was I thinking? It's all part of life, and it's like, you know, I had ridiculous hair, you probably had, or whatever, the outfits, or, you know, whatever you like. It's, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. It's like, we're not supposed to like it. It's not supposed to be our thing. And the fact that we don't like it or don't understand it doesn't really mean anything. It's not for us. And I agree with you. It's like, you know, just let it go if it's not your thing. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. But if it's the thing of somebody, you should make sure that you give it a good place and you feature it. You know. So Kevin beat Ambrose and Zayn in the main event. They had a really good match. The both local got really good babyface pop, which I think was really great because Kevin, the last time in September, got kind of a mixed reaction. But he did so much local media here. All the television shows have been trying to get him. He did another one this time around, and he did the biggest one ever over the summer, over the winter, which is a show that has over 1 million people watching every week. So a lot of people know him, and, you know, he's really made a breakthrough as far as being known here in the province. So it was a great main event and probably the best match on the show.
Interesting. So are those guys main eventing anywhere else that you know on the house shows, or is it just for Montreal?
I don't know. I mean, the you see the lineup, you know, there was, you know, either they were going to main event with Brock and Harper, or they were going to main event with that match, you know. So apparently they went with this one. I think tonight Kevin has tweeted that he's with AJ in a 30-minute Ironman match in Atlantic City. So he's done even on the Toronto show. So I don't know what's going to be the main event on the Atlantic City show, since Ambrose is going to be in Toronto working with Triple H. So maybe that's going to be the main event there. I don't know. But obviously, you know, as far as, you know, the roster goes, there is a depth issue as far as, you know, who can be what on what show. And I think it was the first time that they had Kevin actually, you know, in this case, you know, it was really Kevin and Zayn really main eventing the show. And it went over well. You know, the crowd was ready for it. And it was really nice to you know, that they both get really good home local boy pops, just like in the day of the Russo and the Bravos and all those guys.
How did they react to Dean Ambrose? Was he a heel or was he still popular?
No, he got a good babyface reaction, not as strong as he usually gets, I would say.
Yeah.
But even if Kevin was technically the heel, you know, he was the one who got the win and all of that, and he had a little bit of heat because he kept playing, you know, his usual character, but it you know, it was kind of weird. But, you know, people wanted the Quebecer guy to win. That's pretty much sure. You know, one of the biggest pop was when they did a false finish on and Zane, you know. It looked like maybe Zane was getting it, and that got a huge reaction. So.
Gotcha. We're talking with Bert Running-Bear, or as he would be known in the United States, Bert Hebert.
Yeah.
And we're talking to him. He's a great expert on Montreal wrestling, along with his partner in crime, Pat LaPrade, who will have to get on the show one time soon. But he wrote the great book on Montreal wrestling, which we'll get into, talking about Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screw Jobs. Plus, he wrote a book about Mad Dog Vachon, one of the legends of Montreal wrestling and professional wrestling. It's only in French right now. Do we know if that's going to come out in English or when it's going to come out in English? Because I'm dying for that book.
ECW Press has it for a translation, so that's on its way. But from what we understand, it's going to be somewhere in 2017. So a little bit more patience is going to be in order for this one. But,
all right.
You know,
you also,
going to be there. We'll be on the show if you want, and we'll talk about it.
Oh, anytime.
When it comes out.
You guys are always welcome. You're always welcome. Love you guys. And also, you are the ghostwriter for the upcoming Pat Patterson WWE book called Accepted. I guess we're right now, since it hasn't come out, we're a little bit limited on what you can say, and we don't want to get you in trouble, but when is it coming out?
It's coming out officially August the 1st. It's going to be available everywhere. And we're in the last stage, so it's like the final selection on pictures, captions, a few more corrections, and it's been like the project of a lifetime, and it just was amazing to be able to sit with Pat all those hours that we spent together working on his book and getting to, you know, sit at that learning tree as a bonus. You know, that's my bonus. You know, whatever I'm getting out of it, the bonus was being able to spend so much time with Pat and discuss wrestling with him, not just his career, because, you know, we often, you know, he's passionate, I'm passionate about wrestling, so we got carried away a few times talking about different things, and it was amazing. You know, I think I have a good grasp on wrestling, but, you know, he had my head spinning a few times, you know, and I learned so much. It was an amazing experience.
So what do you think was the number one thing you learned? I know it sounds like a lot of things, but what was the most head-spinning thing?
I mean, this... It just the way the, you know, it's it I think, you know, I kind of knew, but it really put the trigger on how important, you know, your presentation is as far as wrestling goes, and you could have really 25,000 move, but if your personality is not over, or if you don't take the time to get, you know, whatever you're doing at that precise moment over, you know, it's going to mean nothing. And it was very interesting for him to point stuff at me, you know, on new things going on, or, you know, we did, when I went to Florida and worked with him for a week, you know, we did watch a few of the NXT shows and stuff like that. And for him to point on stuff, the good stuff, the bad stuff, and whatever was being done right or wrong, it was just amazing. And, you know, he has such an amazing life as well, you know, and he went through so many things, you know. I had no idea, you know, that, you know, he actually had two run in Portland, because you were speaking about Portland, but Portland was very important territory. That's where Maurice brought him in first, because, you know, before that he was doing, you know, stuff in Boston for Santos, and, you know, was thinking maybe that, you know, that was going to be it for as far as wrestling goes. From there, you know, in that run, he was sent to Texas, Arizona, and a few other places before going back to Portland. And this is where the second run in Portland, where he really, like, he started to light up and became a main event guy. And, you know, he was Pacific Northwest champion and all of that. And And from that run, that built to him getting into San Francisco and becoming the legend he was with Ray Stevens.
And for decades now, he's been one of Vince McMahon's key creative forces in the WWF, and you can read all about it coming up on August 1st. So be sure to look for that, and we'll have you on the show again if WWE allows it. I don't know how it's all.
I don't know. Frankly, we don't know exactly how things are going to be going as far as that goes.
Sure.
I'm not sure they use to have a ghostwriter that is connected in kind of the wrestling medias and has some, you know, people that might be interested in talking to him. But obviously, you know, this is going to be Pat project before anything else. So from there, you know, I don't know how it's going to go. But, you know, I mean, the only one thing I want to say is that, you know, you always believe that, you know, well, if it's a WWE book, they're going to cut everything out, which I can tell you they didn't cut that much. and they didn't cut the good stuff. So I was pretty amazed because, you know, you don't know, you know, I've never had anybody go through a book so much, but at the same time, you know, it's there. It's Pat's story, the way he told it, and the wording we came up with, and, you know, and everything's there, which I think is great, you know.
That's awesome. We're talking with Bert Ronnie Baer. He's the author of the upcoming Pat Patterson book, Accepted. Also wrote Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, and the Mad Dog Vachon biography that is currently in French, but look for it in English coming up next year. This is all brought to you by PWTorch.com, PWTorch.com/GoVIP. Sign up, especially with WrestleMania season coming up. There's so much content on the Torch from all of the shows, all of the latest news, and the best analysis, the best writing you're going to find anywhere in the wrestling world, so be sure to check that out at pwtorch.com/govip. Let's take a couple of calls here for Bert. Let's go to 862. 862, you're on the live cast. Who's this and where are you calling from?
Kylan from North New Jersey.
All right, Kylan, what do you got for us, man?
Okay, my first question for Bert, if there is any footage left over that you know of, who owns the Grand Prix Wrestling Library from Frank Valois?
Okay. As far as Grand Prix Wrestling goes, okay, Grand Prix shut down. Okay, so the company never went into bankruptcy or anything like that. Nobody at the time had any idea that any of those tapes might have any kind of value at any point in time. So what happened is that nobody from the company really kept anything. And the only one still alive is Tony Mule, which was a wrestling promoter in Montreal, which is probably one of the last living person who had a stake in Grand Prix Wrestling when the company shut down. We have found, I think, 5 episodes that were, as far as I know, secretly taken out of CFCF 12's vault at some point in Montreal. So those are English version of the show. There is no French version of the show that I've known of. And from there, those 5 episodes, I've been going around, you know, I had like 3 of them at some point, and we came up with 2 more quite recently. And that's all, as far as I know, that's all that there is as far as Grand Prix goes. And so technically, Tony Mule would be the owner of whatever footage, but there's no master tapes. There's whatever people have at this point. So they kind of fall into a crack as far as who owns, as far as we can secure, as far as legally we can find. That's what we have right now. Some of the best stuff from those episodes are part of the DVDs that we've, you know, because as we came up with the book, a lot of people wanted to see footage, so I went into my archives of stuff I had get together over the years, and we came up with a few DVDs that are available through iSpots.com or through RFVideo.com called Golden Age of Quebec Wrestling. And whatever is best of Grand Prix is in there. We, as far as international wrestling goes, and Frank Valois' promotion in Montreal, that is different because it went into bankruptcy. So, once again, no master tapes of anything was ever kept by anyone because nobody could see any value in it. From what we understand, you know, when the bankruptcy happens, there was some stuff left that were destroyed because nobody wanted it. And Tony Mullet, who was also part owner of International Wrestling when it went into bankruptcy, did tell us that he had some master tapes left at some point, which were damaged or, no, I think they were thrown away by mistakes by one of his son or something that didn't know what it was. And, you know, so there's no way to get back to those. International Wrestling had three commercial VHS out back in the days, like the good old Coliseum video thing that WWE was releasing at the time. So those three still exist in fairly good shape. And, you know, through the years, either through tape collecting or tape trading or whatever, there is quite a few hours of international wrestling that became available through the years. And, you know, we, again, including in the DVDs for Golden Age of Quebec Wrestling, we went in there and picked whatever was in good quality or very rare or very interesting, you know, like the Dino Bravo against Rick Martel match, which was a famous match in Montreal at the Colisée de Quebec that I remember very fondly. And there's a few matches from Andre the Giant and Mad Dog from Grand Prix and King Tonga and Dino Bravo, which was, again, a big program here in Montreal, and the obvious Rougeau against the Garvin program, which was an amazing, amazing program, which was probably the biggest thing, the last biggest thing ever in Montreal at wrestling, as far as a program making a big difference at the box office. So that's also available, and that was included in some of the our DVDs. We have three volumes for the Golden Age of Quebec Wrestling. We thought we were done, but recently Ray Rougeau somehow found a big bag of tapes, but nothing that could be used. You know, it had to be transferred and everything. So that just had been done. And, you know, there is some first-time-ever footage from Les As de la Lutte, which was All-Star Wrestling back in the day, that the company competing against Grand Prix. So there was no footage of that. Those are all black and white, and some of them don't even have commentaries on it. So we're working on a project of getting that together for four DVDs and using that footage, and maybe have Ray himself do some of the commentaries on those, since there is no commentaries. So that's the future project. But as far as Montreal Wrestling, this is the footage that exists. There was some footage from the Eddie Quinn era, very few matches. Those also are included in the DVDs. We actually had to buy footage from Radio-Canada, which is the biggest broadcast station in Montreal that used to broadcast the Eddie Quinn show. And they have about six matches, complete matches, still in their archive. So we were able to get footage from them to include on our DVD. So making it really a best compilation, I think, of those footage, because we put everything back together as far as a chronological order. We, you know, put interviews with matches and making so that it makes sense to watch. And it's not just like, you know, you have a box full of VHS, and if you want to watch everything, it's going to take you forever, and, you know, not that much is that great after so many years. But, you know, we have three DVDs, 4 hours each, and it's the best of the best of whatever is available. But, you know, international wrestling and Grand Prix kind of fall into something that nobody really knows anything about, is that, you know, no master tapes exist. And as far as international wrestling, there was no ownership of anything at the end. So whatever is in there is stuff that people have saved over the years. So from there, you know, as far as we know, it's kind of a, you know, there is no decision of who owns what. You know, it's kind of become public domain in a sense.
All right, Kylan, let's do one more question. What do you got for us? Give us your best shot.
Exactly how underrated do you or Jim believe Rick Martel is as a wrestler?
But I don't think Rick Martel is underrated as far as his wrestling goes. I think he was one of the best technical wrestlers of his era. He certainly proved it, you know, becoming AWA champion and WWE tag team champion. And if you watch his matches today, most of them still are very entertaining, even though, you know, the business has evolved and changed a lot in the past 20 years. So, at that sense, I think he's underrated on the fact that, you know, if the Godfather can make it to the WWE Hall of Fame, I think the model Rick Martel should have been in there for quite some time. And in that sense, I think he's really underrated. I think, you know, he has created a lot of memories. I love your analogy about that. I think the model, everybody remembers the model. Everybody remembers arrogance and all of that. So I think, you know, on that sense, and as far as mic work goes, when he was a heel, I think that some of his best work on the mic was as a heel, because as a baby face, you know, the accent and the way he talked was never really his best feature. But, I mean, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Rick Martel was my favorite wrestler ever. So, for me, you know, he was my hero. He was my idol. Rick Martel was awesome, and I followed his career. And today, I'm very blessed to call him a friend. So,
I agree with Bert on that. By the way, I grew up watching Rick Martel here in Portland, where in the late 70s and around 1980, he was like, you know, the A number, you know, Piper and he were both the number one babyface, and they made a tremendous tag team here in Portland, where in the sense that Rick Martel kind of provided the great in-ring work, and Piper kind of provided the sizzle. I mean, they were amazing here, and it's too bad that, you know, Portland isn't more regarded and more widespread as far as popularity, because if they had, I think that he and Piper would be a legendary tag team. So I'm a big Rick Martel guy, and I think that everyone always knew that he was a great wrestler and that his wrestling was on par with anybody in that era. But I think that when he became the model, which at first, when I first saw that, I was like, oh, Rick Martel sold out too. But when he became the model, I think he impressed everyone with his ability to do the showmanship style of wrestling. And when people talk about work in wrestling, usually what they mean is, oh, can he do, you know, a springboard moonsault or something. But really what it means is connecting with the crowd and doing more with less. And I think when he became the model, he really showed that he was an all-around wrestler, where he could do the promos and the presentation and get the crowd going with, say, his jumping jacks or whatever, and not just his really smooth in-ring style. And I would love it, Bert, if maybe sometime in the future, you know, that I could get Rick on the show and just talk about the territory days and talk about Portland and everything. I'm a big Rick Martel guy. I love Rick.
Hey, listen, he considers himself retired and doesn't want to do those. But, you know, as I always say to people, I'll bring your request and see how it goes.
I think as far as any of
you
know, I think he might actually
talk about Roddy and talking about Portland and all of that. I think he might be up for it.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot about his career, not just the model stuff. So, no, I'd love to talk about it. There's a great story that Martel tells about, you know, when in 1980, when Piper and Martel were here and they were running the roads together, that they were driving in a car right after Mount St. Helens blew. And there was all of the ash and everything, and it was just incredible. But, no, if we could put something together, I think he might actually enjoy this interview, considering, but we'll see. We're talking with Bert Ronnie Bear. He's the author of Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs. Also, the upcoming Pat Patterson book with Accepted that's coming out in August. So be sure to check that out. Also, want to mention that coming up in a couple of weeks, we've got a lot of stuff coming up. Next week, we're going to have Mike Mooneyham finally, just retired from the Charleston Post and Courier. Also, the week after that, in 2 weeks, we've got a great guest that's creating a lot of buzz, and I don't know that she's done anything anywhere. But we've got Rhonda Shear from Up All Night, from the old Monday Night Raw days in the mid-90s. She's going to come on the show and talk about WrestleMania 10 and her work with WWE and all that fun stuff. And I'm really looking forward to that. I think it should be a ton of fun. So on the 26th, it's going to be Rhonda Shear. Also, coming up, we're going to have one of the Romero brothers, Jay Youngblood's brother, is going to come on. We'll talk about Jay Youngblood and the road to Greensboro and the legacy of the Romero and Youngblood families in wrestling. So we've got a lot of stuff coming up in the future. We're also going to have, in a couple of weeks, I think the first weekend in April, we're going to have B. Brian Blair on to talk about the Cauliflower Alley Club, which is the reunion's coming up here in just a couple of weeks in April as well. So we'll have him on to talk about Cauliflower Alley in Vegas, and we'll do some stuff. I'm actually going to go to Cauliflower Alley this year. I haven't been in a long time, so that should be a lot of fun. So lots of great stuff.
It's going to be my first time at the CAC, so.
Oh, you're going this year?
Yeah, I'm going this year, first time. So.
Oh, that's awesome. Let you and I hook up. I'd love to hang out with you.
For sure.
Yeah, I've gone once. Once I went in 2009, but this will be my second time going. It's something that every wrestling fan should do, and in the sense that it's super, super affordable, relatively speaking, to go. I mean, the Gold Coast Hotel is a value hotel, and it's still really clean and really nice. I mean, you get a lot for your money. I mean, it's like $36 a night if you get the package, I think. And
yeah,
the package right now... Yeah, so sign up right now. Yeah, I think the group rate is only good through Monday or Sunday or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I read something. I think on March 16, you can still get the best. They extended it to March 16. You can get the package for the room, which is about $36 a night or something. And, you know, if you hang with Pat LaPrade and myself, you know, Pat LaPrade always find the cheapest beer in Vegas. So, you know, there's nothing better to do than to hang around with the guy from Montreal.
That's funny. This year they're going to be honoring Trish Stratus with the Iron Mike Mazurki Award. Lou Thesz, Art Abrams Lifetime Achievement Award, is going to Arn Anderson. 2016 Men's Wrestling Award going to Paul Orndorff, also Ken Patera. Tag team being honored, the High Flyers, Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel. They're also going to honor Pepper Martin with the Real Award. Referee Award is going to be James Beard. The Humanitarian Award is going to Sue Aitchison. And the reason that I'm going this year, I mean, that's a hell of a lineup. That's a great Cauliflower lineup. But I'm going because the 2016 Announcers Award is Lance Russell. And, you know, he's really getting up there. And I need to meet Lance Russell and get a picture just one time. I mean, he was so great on Memphis Wrestling. Just an amazing broadcaster. And I'm going to see Lance Russell, but that is a hell of a lineup. And be sure to get your tickets. It's like $130 for the weekend with all the different shows and the banquet and the Bockwinkle Baloney Blowout. And they have seminars and things. It's a tremendous value for everything you get. And, you know, so many great wrestling fans and wrestlers. And it's a fun time. So be sure to check it out. You can look it up at CauliflowerAlleyClub.org if you want to check it out. But gosh, you guys are going to be there, so that'll be awesome.
Yeah, for Pat, I've been going the past few years, but it's going to be my first year. That's the one that was missing on my bucket list, and I wanted to go to Vegas as well. So that's perfect. So I'm really, really, really happy about that. Looking forward to it, and it's even better that you're going to be there. So we're going to be able to hang around a little bit.
Yeah, that would be great. I love that. Let's go to 773, which I think is the infamous Boris from Chicago. Boris, what's going on, man? Are you there? 773, hello. Boris.
Hey.
What's going on, man?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you a little bit.
I was just, when you got on the subject about the, over there in Toronto and, we have a really good had a really good pool and still getting a really good pool of talent from Canada and stuff like Bret Hart, and now we got Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens. What do you think about that? That's my first question.
That's a good question, Bert. What is it about Canada and wrestling in the sense that it seems to be such a lively and thriving area for wrestling? You know, just the country, I mean, particularly Eastern Canada with Toronto and Montreal and what have you. But not only is it thriving, but it's a very intelligent and passionate crowd. What is it about Canada and wrestling?
I think there's a rich tradition behind it. And also, it kind of always been treated a little more seriously. And there is, as far as the media goes, for a long time it was treated like almost as a shoot for a long time, and today, you know, it has gone pretty, and it's getting faster away from the, well, is it fake question, as more of an entertainment review type thing, you know. So if I'm going to see a movie, you know, people want to hear about that movie, and it's the same thing with wrestling. So it's being treated more and more as a review of an entertainment show, and I think it's passing slowly along towards something else. So that serious aspect around wrestling, that it was always taken as something not to be laughed at or be mocked, I think it shows, as far as getting people really passionate about this, and when they really want to do it, you know, they put all their heart into it, and you know, it gets going, you know, and from there, you know, I think that the from Toronto area to the Calgary area to the Montreal area, there is a rich history of local promotion and found memories for people and all of that. So I think that's a lot of it, and we're so close to the U.S. You know, I have undying admiration for someone like Cesaro, or somebody from like Emma, who comes like from Australia, from Europe, you know, to be, you know, it's quite a step to find a way to make it. But for Canadians, you know, it doesn't seem like the impossible dreams to get discovered by WWE. So, you know, people who really are really good, you know, really put all their heart into it, and they really give it their all. So.
Interesting. Anything else, Boris?
Yeah, this is what is based on, the Hall of Fame, and specifically Terry Gordy and his tag team contribution, which is he was part of Dark and Gordy. And I was thinking on the hand of how single wrestlers, you know, toward the end of their career, they became tag teams like the Hardliners, Dick Slater, and, you know, because we're talking about the past, the Heartland, Dick Slater, and what's the other one? Dick Murdoch, right? And we're thinking,
yep.
I'm just thinking how we had excellent single guys becoming tag teams and doing a really good job back in history. You know, maybe you can say a little more about that and sort of speak on Terry Gordy and then, you know, as a tag team.
What are your thoughts on Terry Gordy, Bert?
Terry Gordy was a wrestling prodigy, you know. At 16, you know, he started his career, and from all accounts, he was already really good. So good, in fact, that, you know, Hayes, who wasn't the greatest of wrestling mechanics, you know, thought he was the perfect partner to go with his sizzle. And from there, they became the best of friends. But, and, you know, by the end, you know, when Terry Gordy was at his best, you know, he was probably one of the best worker of all time. So it goes beyond, I think, being part of a tag team as far as Terry Gordy goes. He was just an amazing worker, period. And, you know, if you find the right era and you go and look into his Japanese work also, wow. I remember even when he came in with Williams and they had the matches with the Steiner in WCW. Those were great. So it goes back a long, long time as far as Terry Gordy goes. It goes beyond, I think, being part of a tag team or anything like that.
Yeah, very versatile as far as the things he could do, and the Miracle Violence connection. I mean, an amazing tag team with that stiff, strong Japan style that really defined the era of Japan, of Japanese wrestling then, All Japan and what have you. But I doubt WWE is going to focus on that. Maybe you'll get a clip, maybe, but I doubt it. I think it's primarily just going to be Freebird stuff.
Oh, yeah, hey, as far as All the Fame goes, yes. But as far as talent goes, I think Terry Gordy was an amazing talent. And, you know, if his destiny would have been different, who knows, you know, what could have been accomplished.
Hey, I'm getting word here. A couple of websites are reporting, and I don't know if this is true or not, but we'd like to talk about what's happening in the now, even though there's a retro show. But there's word that longtime enhancement talent Charlie Fulton has died. A longtime WWE guy that was on Superstars a lot. That's the word that Charlie Fulton, apparently there's a Facebook post from Sal Corrente that says Charlie Fulton passed away.
Okay.
Charlie Fulton... Yeah, I haven't seen anything yet either, but that's what it says. And if that's true, he was an enhancement guy, Southern guy, it reminds me, this week I was watching old Tuesday Night Titans, the TNT show, and there is an episode, it's episode 32, where they have unsung heroes on the show, and they bring out a panel of guests. They bring out Rusty Brooks and Jose Luis Rivera and Steve Lombardi, and then they do another panel with Charlie Fulton and one of the Young Stallions, I think it's Jim Powers and somebody else, I don't remember. But they do a panel with the unsung heroes, as they call them. And it's kind of an interesting concept, that something they would never, ever in a million years do in our ratings-obsessed world. But back then, it's a pretty entertaining episode. So if you want to see that, it's episode 32. It's from May 2nd, 1985. And they show squash matches with the guys, and they talk about their careers. And it's a pretty interesting interview. So, yeah.
Yeah, Greg Oliver just confirmed it on Slam Wrestling.
Okay.
So we died yesterday, apparently.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know. I don't know a lot about Charlie Fulton, but I do remember him quite a bit.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty much the same for me. I mean, those guys are really unsung heroes, you know, because we all remember seeing them, you know. My favorite back in the day was Rusty Brooks.
Yeah,
and
he's on that TNT show, and he's actually really well spoken as far as being a heel and cutting a heel promo and saying how he's better than everybody else and he's just a step away from being world champion or a superstar, and it's pretty funny.
Yeah. So, this is going to happen, this is going to happen more and more, you know. So a lot of those guys, from 20, 35 years ago are going to be going away at some point. It's just life, you know. We're not getting out of here alive, you know. None of us is getting out of here alive, so.
So as we're coming down to the last few minutes, we should probably focus a little bit on just to kind of get a big picture of the Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screw Jobs with Montreal Wrestling. One of the things, it's been a little while since I've read the book, and it is an excellent book, so be sure to pick it up wherever you buy your wrestling books if you haven't yet. As far as historically, but for me what it did was put into perspective where a lot of guys seemingly in that era, there wasn't internet and there wasn't a great deal of cable saturation. So for me, it really put into perspective where some people went at times when they seemingly disappeared from U.S. wrestling. And it also talked about, where a lot of people, like King Tonga, for example, and what have you. And one of the things that I remember about the book that you talked about as it relates to the more modern era in the 80s and 90s is that this is a great description, that WrestleMania 3 was really the Montreal WrestleMania, as far as so many guys that were taken from Montreal Wrestling with WWF, and a lot of them made their first appearances or major appearances on the WrestleMania 3 card.
No, that show has everybody that was anybody from Montreal, from Little Beaver to Edouard Carpentier on French commentary. Because here that was one of the perks here, at the video store. We actually had the WrestleMania 3 on VHS for rent in French and WrestleMania 3 for rent in English. So all those guys from Carpentier to the Rougeaus to Bravos to Martel to Tom Zank, all those guys, they were in Montreal the year or the year and a half just before WrestleMania 3. And Andre and, even Hogan back in 1980 and a few years also was in Montreal again. So it just, all those guys that WWE picked up, they were the cream of the crop. And those, they all went through the Montreal territory at some point. Even guys like Butch Reed had spent some time in Montreal. and it was on the WrestleMania card. So it was just amazing. And you don't look at it that way when the first time around, you know, because you know, at the time, you know, I don't think any local fans of the local promotion was really happy about WWE taking over their territory, and you know, Montreal was no different from anyone else. You know, it did create a lot of new fans, but the original fans, you know, we're kind of pissed because, you know, we were losing our hero, and they had new casting for them and all of that. But if you look back at it today, it's kind of amazing that we had all those talents come true and watch on our TV, local TV show. And those guys were, a lot of them were on the WrestleMania 3 card. And a few more followed on the WrestleMania 4 card and so forth. So, well, you know, that really showed, you know, how well the territory was doing. And, you know, the more I've learned, you know, we had a strong connection to every territory somehow. You know, Dino had work in Charlotte. In Charlotte, I think, for Jim Crockett. Martel had strong tie to the AWA. And with Andre originally, they had strong tie to the New York territory. So they had access to pretty much everybody at some point. So it was just a question of timing. And through that, you know, guys like King Tonga would become Haku. You know, that was the first big territory where he got his first break, and you know, he became huge. You know, he was the first outsider to become a big babyface as well when he turned and he became Dino Bravo's partner. That was a big deal because usually Dino Bravo's partner were more opponents were more like in. And then out, you know, never, you know, they were to hang around and become partners or anything like that. So
Maybe I don't know enough about Montreal wrestling, but one of the things that makes me kind of sad, we were talking about Buddy Rose earlier and the memories of him, that the memories of him by most people are the big fat Buddy Rose and the blowaway diet and the 217 pounds when he was so much more than that. Dino Bravo, in my opinion, was so much more than just the bleach blonde, overly jacked, lethargic muscle guy in WWF when he was Canadian heavyweight champion, and you know he was a really big deal and much more dynamic than the Dino Bravo that we saw on the national stage in the early 90s.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine because it's really two different casting with the same name, you know. Because in his role in WWE, that was all the strongman gimmick, and it was all about power move, and he was getting older as well because, you know, had been at it for 20 years at that point almost. You know, he had started in the early 70s and were, you know, like 15, 16 years in by the time he got to WWE in that role. So, and that's just here, you know, he became probably the third biggest babyface in history as far as the Montreal territory goes. You know, after Yvon Robert, which is in a class of its own because back in the 50s and all that, it just, you know, he was all by himself and, you know, there was not that many different sports, so he became much bigger. Lost a little bit through history, but at the time, nobody was ever bigger as a wrestler than him. Then, you know, there's Johnny Rougeau, who became such a legend and created the dynasty of the Rougeau family. But then Dino in the 80s, you know, he was Superman, and he had that fire. He had an incredible fire when he was selling, and his comeback are something when he was a babyface. You know, I remember the comeback, and I didn't know it was a comeback back then. But, you know, when I started to learn more about the business and work in it and book, and, you know, it just like I realized off on fire his comebacks were and how much they gave, you know, why I remember them so much. And I remember, you know, sitting with my brother at ringside at the forum, and you know if Dino can just, like, you know, and he had that little dance that he did when he was getting mad and that he was, you know, gonna make his comeback, and we, you know, we'd jump out of our seat when he was doing that, and we knew it was coming. And it's funny because when my brother ended up wrestling years later, you know, we did copy the Dino Bravo little dance for his fire comeback. and I still like it when my brother did it, because, you know, nobody was doing it, and he was just getting mad and doing the little steps and then doing the big knockout punches. Just, I don't know, they're just, you know, when something gets over in a territory, it's just, there's just no way for somebody outside to truly understand what it meant. And it's a lot the same thing right now with NXT. The biggest mistake they're doing usually with the NXT guy, I think, is to just bring them to Raw and SmackDown, thinking that it would, whatever they were doing is going to carry over by itself. You know, you're still not at a point where everybody watching Raw and SmackDown are watching NXT on the network. You're not at that point yet. And you know, you need to kind of start them over. And it's the same thing back in the day when the territory, when they were bringing a new guy into WWF. If they were just, except like a guy like Flair, who did carry more over, but if you were bringing somebody and you just throw him in there, Terry Taylor might be a good example. It just wasn't enough. You needed to start something new, and that they did try the Red Rooster, and actually people remember the Red Rooster a lot more than they remember Terry Taylor by now. So it's a little bit like that. I think whatever is happening in a territory at a certain point in time and gets over, you know, it's not, it's kind of like magic, you know. And for whatever reason, it's working with that crowd at that point in time. And it's not usually, it's not clear that it's going to be exportable to another territory or being easy to understand 20 years later. But to have lived it, it just was amazing. And you know, the Rougeau were much better worker than Dino, and people remember their matches with the Rockers and all of that. But the heat and the feeling of them working with the Garvin after the Garvin had beat up their dad on Saint Jean Baptiste Day, which is our national holiday, and you know, just that there is no feeling. I get goosebumps just thinking about that match, you know, because we were so much into it, you know, and there's just no way for people today, even trying to explain that to my kids, what it meant to go to a show without knowing so much about the business, you know, and be into it so much, and more into the conflict and the story than into the matches themselves or whatever. So, you know, you have to live it, I think, to truly understand it. And Dino goes into that category. If you didn't see him and were there, even if you watch tape, it doesn't come off the same way, because, you know, that connection is kind of lost if you didn't get to make it back in the day.
Another guy who you mentioned briefly, who I think was really underrated as far as his promos and his personality, and who's been good since he was really young, I think, is Jacques Rougeau.
Yeah.
And everyone knows him as the Mountie and stuff, but there's stuff from Memphis, like 82, when he's feuding with Terry Taylor, that is just, he's so good at getting under people's skin and knowing what to say and how to act. I think he's really underrated as far as his working ability and his promo ability.
I mean, it's for sure that, you know, when you grew up in a wrestling family, you're going to pick up quite a few things along the way, you know. I can have discussion today with my almost 16-year-old son, and he gets the business so much more than I did at his age, that's for sure, and more than some people working on the local scene sometimes get, because, you know, he goes beyond a little bit fandom, and, you know, now he dreams of becoming a wrestler. He's starting Olympic wrestling at school, and that's his goal, and he just want to talk about it and learn about it and get the psychology behind it. So I see that, you know, he has that thing going for him, that he can learn a lot of, you know, psychology-wise now that, you know, sometimes people that get in late in the business will get later. And I think in the case of Jacques, it's something similar, you know. He was there at ringside with his brothers and for his father's match, and he just was a sponge. You know, you learn more. And even though, you know, as young kids, you know, they were being kept in the dark as far as all the business worked. But, you know, he still was brought in, you know, a lot faster than most people, you know. So I think that really makes a difference.
Sheesh. Bert, we have to get you back on because we haven't touched Mad Dog. We haven't touched Yvonne Robert. There's so many people we haven't touched on that we could go. We could go for hours and hours
and still have stuff to talk about.
Well, let's get you on again soon, and let's get maybe Pat on in the future, and maybe if we can keep our fingers crossed, we're lucky enough. Maybe even Rick Martel, but I won't push it. I'm just going to leave it out there. But I think he would.
Yeah, I mean, you know. I'll make a pitch for it, and you know, I'll keep you updated
if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But I would like to think that I know enough about his career and his early stuff that he might actually enjoy it. We'll see. Who knows?
Yeah,
I'm a big fan. But if it works, great. If not, we'll have you on. Everyone, look for the book with Pat Patterson
Mad Dog
called Acceptance.
Scooter.
And Mad Dog Coming Nuggets. Yep, and also if you do read or know French, you can find the Mad Dog Vachon book, but look for it next year if it's in English. I'm really looking forward to that book. He's a classic character. Do you have any other projects?
Not right now. No other project as far as writing. You know, we do have the DVDs available, like I discussed, The Golden Age of Quebec Wrestling through iSpots.com and RF Video. And except for that, obviously, you know, I'm hopeful that the Patterson book, you know, will bring me to another project. Because, you know, I just love wrestling, and I want to write about it more and do more about the thing that I'm the most passionate about. And there's just not enough time in the day to talk about wrestling. So hopefully, you know, there's more project. Each project has led to the next. So hopefully the Patterson book, once it comes out, will lead me to another project.
Well, you sound like the perfect guy to be writing the Patterson book, and I'm very excited. When I first saw the title, I was like, oh, I hope it's just not about, you know, the social aspect of his sexual preference, because the guy's a genius, regardless of what he does in his private life. But I'm glad to hear that so much of that and the stories and all of Patterson's knowledge is going to come through on the book, and I think that's a worthy thing for Patterson's legacy and a book about Pat.
Yeah, but it was important for him to have his life there. Not, you know, it's not a book about, you know, the description of all the title matches that he ever had in his life. That's for sure. That's not the book. If you want description of title matches of Pat Patterson's career, that's not what we do in the book. It's his journey through territory to territory, the people he met, the people that became his mentors, the people he become mentors to. And through all that, well, there is Louis, and with the man he was with for 40 years, and their life together as a gay couple back in those times. So I think it's an amazing story, and you learn a lot about the wrestling. There is plenty for wrestling fans, but there's also plenty for all human beings to learn in there. So that's a pretty cool book.
Coming out in August, accepted. Look for it and ask for it by name. Bert Ronnie Bear, thank you so much for the time. I really, really enjoyed it. Great show. We'll definitely have you on again. Thank
Perfect.
You. There's, there he is. There's the man. Have a good day, Bert. And we will talk at you later. Fun show today. What a great, great show. Gosh, thanks to everybody. Sorry I missed a few calls. It just happens. But don't let it discourage you from calling in next time or tweeting me at Jim Valley. You can also find Bert Ronnie Bear on Twitter. Look at my Twitter, and you can find Bert if you want to hook up with him. You can do it that way as well. And next week, Mike Mooneyham, mid-Atlantic guy, great friend with Ric Flair. We'll talk to him. And then the week after that, the 26th, Rhonda Shear from USA, Up All Night and WrestleMania 10. That's going to be an amazing interview, so get ready for that. I'm Jim Valley. Hope you have a great week. And remember, as always, you don't have to be white to be white trash.
See ya!